I'm Mayim Bialik, and I'm on the tightrope.
We are witnessing America as a failed social experiment.
How do we tell this story in a way that builds the kind of emotional momentum that colorblind ideology built?
So many young brothers and sisters of the younger generation find themselves so far removed from the best of their past.
What are we going to make out of the nothing we've been given? How do you envision possibility?
Hey everyone, thanks for joining us on The Tightrope, where we engage in a love and justice-infused dialogue, and we try desperately to keep our balance on tough issues. I'm Tricia Rose, and I'm here with my co-host and dear friend, Dr. Cornel West. Before we get started in this episode, and we have a really interesting, creative, wonderful guest today, but before we get started, I want to remind everyone about our new Patreon account. And we want people to join us there for all kinds of interesting outtakes, longer discussions. Sometimes we break into song because we like music. And we want you to hang out with us there when you can. So come to patreon.com/thetightropepod. And you'll find all sorts of cool extras. And we'd love to see you there. So come on and join us. All right, Cornel, how are you doing? Let's get on this tightrope today. What's going on?
I tell you, anytime I'm in dialogue with you, I know I can be a force for good if I can get my heart, mind, and soul together. We've got such a magnificent guest coming in just a few minutes as well. So we both have smiles on our faces.
We do. We do. And, you know, it is much 2021's turning a corner, I think. You know, I have a little bit more hope that things might start moving toward a reasonable direction. So I'm cautiously hopeful. So I'm feeling a little bit better, actually, just a little bit. How are you feeling?
Well, you know, I've been reading some Isaac Bashevis Singer and all of that deep, dark wisdom. Love is there, but the unflinching engagement with evil in its various forms are there as well. And so in that sense, again, it's a matter of being fortified as opposed to being simply projected in a certain line. You just don't know what's coming your way, but whatever comes your way, you got your family, you got your tradition, you've got your heritage critically appropriated in such a way that it can sustain you in the midst of whatever grimness you find yourself.
Well, you know, you always remind us about that core, that kind of core context. You know, sometimes I take it as a base, you know, not, I wouldn't say take it for granted, but I work on top of that base. But you're so helpful in reminding us, hey, look, you got to look down and make sure you're standing on what you're supposed to be standing on, because you don't really know what's down there all the time. You got to keep your eye on it. Right. So thank you.
That's the truth.
Thank you for that. So we have a really interesting and terrific guest today, and we're so excited about this. I'm going to give her a proper introduction, and you all will just enjoy our conversation, I'm sure. We have Mayim Bialik, very well known for her award-winning role as Amy Farrah Fowler on the hit comedy The Big Bang Theory, which I've watched many a time. And during her 9-year run, she's won a number of awards, 2 Critics' Choice, 4 Emmy Award nominations, and a SAG Award nomination. And then she's, of course, if you remember from the 90s, if you're old enough to remember from the 90s, that seems like yesterday to me, but I've now been told it's damn near 30 years ago, which is not funny, really not funny. Yeah, that's a long time ago, Cornel. But anyway, she was the lead of Blossom, and she's got a new production company and a new show coming out. And we're just thrilled to have you. Mayim Bialik, you are on the tightrope. Welcome to the tightrope.
Thank you. It's really an honor to be here.
Well, thank you. Thank you. So tell us, I have about 97 questions for you. So let me just start with the academic ones, okay? Because we got to get the academic stuff out of the way, because, you know, we got to talk shop for a minute. PhD in neuroscience. Okay. What was your field of interest?
Yeah. My field was psychoneuroendocrinology, which means I studied the endocrine system and specifically the hypothalamus, which is right about in the middle of your brain. It's what connects to the pituitary gland, which most people have heard of. And the hypothalamus is in charge of puberty and hunger and homeostasis. And I studied the role of certain secretions from the hypothalamus in obsessive compulsive disorder. So that's the part that a lot of people say, oh, okay, obsessive compulsive disorder. Got it.
Right,
so
right,
that's what I studied.
But puberty is interesting too, because you also have a number of books related to childhood and adolescence and sort of coming into oneself in a positive way. So that, does that connect to your neuroscience?
Yeah. Background? I mean, you know, I'm trained obviously in, you know, all the things that neuroscientists are trained in at places like UCLA. So my knowledge of the endocrine system and development really informed a lot of what I chose to sort of write about. So I wrote Girling Up, which is about essentially the process by which, you know, girls become women, not only physiologically, but also psychologically and culturally and socially. And then I did Boying Up, which was obviously, I'm not a boy, but I studied the anatomy on both sides. And and that's about, you know, the process by which boys become men, again, physiologically, but also with some, you know, some nods to the psychological processes and again, the social constructs as well.
Mm. Wow. Wow. So all of these things are very interconnected for you. That's interesting. That's really interesting.
But just being able to live in what the old C.P. Snow called the two cultures of science on the one hand and the arts on the other, how do you navigate your way through those two? Because you're a towering artist on the one hand, you're a rigorously trained scientist on the other, and you're still in your right mind. You still got a smile on your face. How do you pull that off, my dear sister?
Everybody's got a story, and mine is that I was raised by two first-generation Americans. So my grandparents were immigrants to this fine country, and my parents were born during World War II. They were civil rights activists and documentary filmmakers. So I was raised by two wacky artists. They were public school teachers, and you know, they were involved in the civil rights movement and having sit-ins to allow Black students into the New York, you know, public school system. And so I was raised by people who loved teaching and saw teaching as a way to essentially foster the next generation. So I was raised a humanities lover, you know, both of my parents, my dad was a poet, and everything in our house was Yeats and Keats and, you know, Cortazar. And it was just a very artsy kind of house. I was not good at math or science, did not think it was for me. And it wasn't until I was actually on Blossom that I learned to love science and believe that I could do it. And part of it was the lack of confidence. I grew up in a culture, you know, I went to public school my whole life here in Los Angeles. And the culture of the 70s and 80s was that science was for boys. And if something wasn't easy for you, it meant you were stupid at it. So find something else. And what I discovered, you know, as a teenager is that sometimes if things are taught to you in a way that you can understand better, you can actually excel. And that was my experience with science. So, you know, after Blossom ended, I was 2 years out of high school. And I decided to go more the academic route for my life. I never really liked fame, wasn't really drawn by money. You know, I didn't grow up with money, so I didn't really know what to do anyway when I started making money. That wasn't interesting to me. I wanted to live the life that my parents lived as academics, you know, and I went to UCLA. I studied neuroscience, and Hebrew and Jewish studies was my minor. So I actually got to use my writing skills and my communication skills so that my GPA didn't suffer, because science is hard for me.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I went straight through to the doctoral program, which was a 7-year program. And I had my first son in grad school and my second right after I took my hood.
Oh, wow. My God, my God.
Yeah.
Now, it's also the case, though, that your family is really one of what I would call artistic nobility and poetic royalty. Bialik is one of the great poets in the modern world, turn of the century. City of Slaughter, one of the greatest poems that we've had in the last 500 years. What was it? What is it like to be part of that legacy?
I mean, I have to tell you, my mind is so blown because my father of blessed memory was an enormous fan and supporter of yours. And if he could know that you and I were discussing our ancestor, Chaim Nachman Bialik, It's unbelievable. I am related on my father's side to the poet laureate of Israel, the Shakespeare of Israel, as they called him. And he was exceptional in that he was from Eastern Europe, but he wrote in the language of Hebrew, which was a dead language. It was a language that was dead for over 1,000 years. And he chose to communicate in not his native tongue and create really, really staggering poetry. So there was, you know, there was a knowledge my whole life that this was our legacy. And when I go to Israel, there's a Bialik Street in every major city. There's a Bialik Museum. where we get in for free.
Absolutely, absolutely. you get in for free too.
Yes.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
And you know, I have a little library of the Bialik books that we have. I think there's one signed copy. I'm his brother's branch, so we didn't have as much direct a contact, but my grandfather did meet him on one of his trips to America.
Right?
My grandfather died, so I didn't get to ask my grandfather in full detail about it. But yeah, it is an amazing thing that in many circles, you know, being an actress on television is not the most interesting thing about me or my name. You know, many people say Bialik. I went to Bialik High School. A lot of high schools are named for him. And he was also a big Zionist voice in the Holocaust as well.
But in that particular poem, in the City of Slaughter, dealing with the Kishinev vicious attack, massacring of precious Jewish brothers and sisters of the Russians, that was part of a whole wave, you know, pogroms after the assassination, of course, in 1881 of the Tsar, that he's talking about how do you fight back? How do you engage in some form of self-respect, or self-defense, self-determination under the most adverse circumstances? You're hated, you're degraded, you're dominated, and so forth. And so it cut radically against the grain of so much of the poetry that flows from the Jewish tradition in that regard.
I mean, look, we are a people of great tragedy and great passion. You know, Bialik really was able to capture a lot of that tension. And I think it's something that, you know, is still relevant today, both fortunately and unfortunately. That kind of struggle, I think we're still very much in touch with as humans.
You know, one of my heroes 40 years ago was Ahak Aham, who was his very, very close friend. When he'd edited The Dawn, they came together. He was the one, they met in Odessa. He goes to Kishinev, spends the months there, engages in the research, comes back and writes this unbelievable poem that, you know, will live forever for anybody who suffers. I mean, not just precious Jewish brothers and sisters, but anybody who suffers in that regard. But then you say to yourself, you say, well, good God almighty, that level of humanistic engagement that we see, not just in Bialik, but one could argue even the best of the, what I call loosely, the legacy of Jerusalem, beginning with Hebrew scripture and then on to Mishrash and Talmud and so forth, on to Kafka. I mean, we can go, you know, it projects it. Susan Sontag, Muriel Rukav,
Bob Dylan, you know, like we've got it all.
Robert Zimmerman from Minnesota.
That's from Hibbing, Minnesota.
You know, how do you hold on to that kind of humanistic sensibility in a world with so much hatred?
This feels like a question far more for you than me. I don't know that I'm any sort of expert. You know, I'm an expert on my own experience. And, you know, I think especially while World War II is not a hallmark of the Jewish faith or Jewish people, you know, I grew up very close to it. You know, it hung very heavily, and it was a major driving point for my parents as civil rights activists. They could not imagine a world where people were treated the way they were being treated when just one generation before them, their parents had to flee, you know, the Nazis.
Right.
It's a really complicated and a really rich culture to come from when it puts you so in touch with suffering and pain. Tragedy plus time is comedy. And there also is, you know, there's a lot in the humor, you know, that I was raised with that, you know, we used to say, if you don't laugh, you'll cry. And you can only cry so much.
True. There's a long history of Blacks and Jews in America having a connection in the ways that you're describing there. You know, that sense of similar, obviously not the same type of legacy. Now, your parents or grandparents were from the Bronx.
My parents were born in the South Bronx.
Ah, okay, yeah, because I'm from the Bronx as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. So
we got two Bronx sisters in the house.
Yeah.
Why don't you sound like us? Trisha, you sound like a normal person.
Because I did not take it on a lot.
We all sound like Al Pacino. What happened to you?
When I get pissed off, I'll say, it's in the top drawer. And my husband will say, are we in the Bronx again? I'm like, yes, until you find it.
Look in the mirror.
Yeah, there are days. It's weird because both of my parents are from New York City. Every day of their lives, they've lived in New York City. I was there till I was 18, you know, and then went to college, but I just don't have an accent. I don't understand it. It's an insult to the Bronx, really, I know. But
I think J-Lo and I are very disappointed in you right now.
Oh, gosh, God, like, not both of you. That's too much. Well, you know, you just got to get me hot under the collar and then you'll get a little.
Or you need to speak to my mother because she brings it out in everybody.
In everyone, right?
No, but just to speak to your point in all seriousness, you know, that absolutely was and is really a foundation of the way I was raised. I was raised with the understanding, you know, that obviously Jews are supposed to welcome the stranger and uphold the fallen and heal the sick. You know, we're supposed to do all those things, but there's a very, very unique and special kinship between the Black and Jewish community and always has been. My younger son carries the middle name Heschel for Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, who marched with Dr. King.
Yeah.
He is right there.
There it is. My younger son is named for Rabbi Heschel. He's also a Frederick for Douglas. So and my older son is Miles for Davis. So we're covered. Well, yeah, we really are, you know, it's something that I was also raised going to public school in Los Angeles where I was the minority. I grew up with Black kids and kids who had just come from Mexico and kids who had come from South Korea. Like I was the odd woman out. And I was part of the busing system of the 70s and 80s. I lived in a neighborhood that wasn't so great. So they put us all on buses early in the morning and I learned every hip hop song on the way to school. I sat in the front row so nobody would beat me up and I listened to hip hop the whole way through.
Okay, so what years of hip hop did you master on your way to public school?
I was born in 1975. I remember when pop music was played on AM radio. That's how old I am.
Right. And no, okay, so you were the early 90s.
Well, but I was put on buses from 1981. And so all through, from the time I was in second grade.
Six, seven years old.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. In New York, they're on public buses. At least I was on a school bus.
Yeah, that's true.
That's true.
Let's not even get into my commute. That's true.
Right. No, I was like the Belle Biv DeVoe, into Poison.
Poison? You were listening to Poison?
All those things. I was an expert in all of that era of hip hop.
Wow.
That was my life, is hearing the stories of my parents teaching. My mother started in the women's prison in Harlem. My parents taught in Harlem. They taught in the Bronx. You know, they also received a lot of flack from a lot of Black parents who said, we don't need white Jews fighting these fights, which was obviously very painful because my parents saw that fight as the fight of humanity. And it's been, you know, especially a devastating year for my mother, who is sitting watching the world unravel still, and that systemic racism is still, like she said, everything I fought for, everything I was tear gassed for, we haven't fixed it, we haven't solved it. And she said, I'm seeing Black lives thrown in the gutter. And she said, we've been fighting for this our whole life, you know, and obviously much longer than that. So it's been a really, really fascinating time also to get to have my mother, who's 75, who lived through an era that did a lot and did not yet finish the work.
Well, God bless her though, because there were a disproportionate amount of young Jewish brothers and sisters who went down into American apartheid.
That's right.
In that Mississippi Freedom Summer of 64.
That's right.
And that's been, of course, historically the case ever since that Eastern European wave. I mean, a little bit different than the German Jewish wave, but the Eastern European Jewish wave after the 1880s came into the United States. Most being tied in Russia and Poland at that time under Russia. And so you know this text here. This is a magnificent text. Jacob and Esau.
I have not read it.
History between, it is a masterpiece. Malachi Hayim Hakone. He teaches at Duke, but he's the first. He's the first major, brilliant historian of Jews to tell the story from the vantage point of not just the more secular assimilated Jews, from Spinoza and Moses Mendelssohn all the way up to Lionel Trilling, but of the rabbis. You see, that has its own intelligentsia behind the Pale of Settlement, its own intelligentsia in organic connection with everyday Jews. University of Berlin, but we're talking about the ones who go to Yeshiva, and they read the Torah, you know what I mean? The Torah, and they sing with the cantor. Like you get a Harold Arlen, you know, his father was a cantor from Buffalo, right? Now he's going to write Stormy Weather and bring in some black folk, and they're going to take it to the height. But I mean, but he's rooted on the Jewish side of Buffalo in that synagogue. Right. And there's a sense in which there's a the secular bias against taking Orthodox Judaism seriously. This is why our dear brother Heschel is so important.
Sure.
And you have been one of those who have been, seems to me, more willing, especially in the context of Hollywood, God bless you, to have an openness to Orthodox Judaism. Could you say something about that, how you've worked with that?
Yeah, I mean, it's, I mean, I never thought I would get to talk to Cornel West about this, but sure.
No, but with all of it, you just sharing, you know.
No, it's, yeah, I was, you know, I was raised, you know, my mother was raised very, very religious. And as soon as she could get out of her parents' home, she, it was the first time she had ever eaten out was with my father on their first date, and she ordered lobster. And so this taught my father, this taught my father that my mother did not want to be kosher anymore and that she had very expensive taste. And my mother was raised in a tenement house in the Bronx. So my mother lived with active tuberculosis in her home. You know, my dad, they had moved to Long Island, you know, that was the American dream then, you know, to get out of the Bronx, go to the island.
Right.
My father came back and married this girl from the Bronx, and they really left religion behind. And I was raised with kind of a smattering of Reform Judaism, which has a lot of like repair the world and a lot of very, very positive liberal values. I really liked it, but I'm the kind of person who really likes structure. I like ritual and I like structure. And as I got older, as I left my parents' home, I went to college, I met Rabbi Chaim Seidler Feller, who was one of the students of Soloveitchik, who was the father of modern Orthodoxy, as we call it. And I had never met someone who both was engaged with modern culture, pop culture, new things, new people, and also maintained a deep intellectual passion for the several thousands of years of tradition that we have. So it was through, I started to learn with him, and Jewish learning is a very specific thing. You have to do it with a partner. That is literally how we do it. You can, of course, read alone, study alone, but our text is meant to be danced with, is what we say. It's not, you don't look at it. You have to move with it. You have to turn it over and over with another person. And that's the structure of Jewish learning. So once I started doing that, I realized that my intellectual self was very satisfied by this line of philosophical thinking. It is absolutely available to all Jews, meaning it's not for the elite. It's, you know, Jews were often taught to read when many people in different classes and other cultures were not. So we were a people of the book. And the level of detail that the rabbis went to is absolutely, in many cases, sounds ridiculous, but it's the thought processes and it's the way we are taught to think that leads to so many jokes and so many stereotypes, you know, like two Jews, four opinions, you know, ha ha ha.
Right.
But it's because we are taught to turn things over constantly. And it could be the kind of bagel to order, or it could be legal code, you know, it could be ethical code about abortion. It could be anything. That's how we engage. So it really was an intellectual passion and a need for honoring, you know, what I see as the beauty of the scientific world, that everybody, you know, experiences gravity. I choose to be grateful to the divinity that I see in the world when I experience gravity. So there's not like a right or a wrong way. You know, if you believe in any power in the universe, it's the same for everyone. We just have different expressions for it. And I, you know, I'm grateful that I was born into this people, and a huge component of my social justice passion and my deep belief that my purpose on this planet is to make it right for other people is because of my
my Jewish identity. And there are many, many ways to be a good person. Religion is not the only way. For me, leading a life of constant attempts at mindfulness, for me, allows me to be more aware of other people and their suffering, and to not be able to avoid when there is injustice. I can't look away. You know, you can't look away.
No, but I mean, that's eloquent. That's eloquent. Because you got the love of learning, of literacy, of language, which is a fundamental pillar of one's individual and collective identity, which is endless, which is always incomplete. So that the tikkun olam can take place, but you never, ever, ever get there, as one of the great rabbis, Teflon, talks about, right?
Yep.
But on the other hand, you got love of stranger, orphan, widow, motherless, fatherless. So you got Baal Shem Tov. I mean, he's John Coltrane. He's John Coltrane, love supreme.
That's right.
You got so much coming out of him all the time. It's an over-loving. Right. It's an over-joy. It's an over-embracing, which is a little different than just the literacy and the learning. He said, I can become idolatrous if it's not connected to that deep hesed, that deep steadfast love, that loving kindness to be embraced in that way. Very, very much so. So you had intellectually work as a science, artistic work as an actor and actress, and then also embracing orthodox versions of Judaism. But then you got to deal with the patriarchy. How do you come to it?
The patriarchy, that's just a constant, isn't it? It's just always there.
Every culture got it. Every religion has it.
And that's what I say to people when people pick on traditional Judaism and, oh, why do you dress this way? Oh, you can't do this. I said, yeah, because we're all living in the patriarchy. We're all in it. What I know is that my God does not have a gender. My God, we don't even have a name. We have a million names for God, and there's female names and there's male names. There's all these different incarnations of our conception, what we are building so that we can explain things. But gravity doesn't get a boy or a girl name. Gravity's above or below the patriarchy. So that is how I see it.
And I do
acknowledge that many people do not want to deal with the level of restriction that exists in traditional Judaism, or really any traditional form of religious practice, because the patriarchy, absolutely, it's very, very prominent. But to me, I am a human being who gets to decide what my life looks like. You don't get to put me in one box and say, oh, because this doesn't align with how I feel about my role as a woman, I throw it away. Or because there's a history of problems here, I throw it away. This is a tradition that is constantly evolving. Yes, there are some people who still dress like they did in the 1800s and don't speak, you know, English or Hebrew, even when they live in countries that do, they speak Yiddish. But this is a culture that always has had to live wherever it was. And Yiddish is one of almost two dozen dialects that Jews had to create wherever they lived. We created hidden languages. We used the Hebrew alphabet and we wrote in the local dialect. Yiddish is only one of those. So everywhere in the world where you find Jews, they've found a way to be part of the culture and also maintain their individual culture. And all of those cultures indeed are still touched by the patriarchy.
No, that's true. No, that's inside the pale, outside of the pale,
Goyim,
Black folk, indigenous people, and so forth and so on. But then at the same time, you've also been willing to hit this complicated, delicate, difficult issue of Zionism in a very, very honest and candid way. How do you deal with that these days in light of precious Palestinian brothers and sisters, our precious Jewish brothers and sisters, our precious, I mean, how does one wrestle with that in terms of being true to this very rich, deep prophetic legacy of Jerusalem?
Yeah. This is one of the main dividing points in the Jewish community. You know, I'm going to speak candidly with you both. It became very clear during this past administration that there were many people who were willing to declare that there's only one way for Jews to vote, and that is Republican. Now, you can tell by the way I was raised, I was taught that the Democratic Party is the party of Judaism because it is the party of
liberty. It is the party of upholding the fallen, healing the sick, freeing the captive, and comforting those who suffer. That's what I'm raised by. My grandparents were sweatshop workers. We are union people. We are workers. We don't take off days when we're sick.
Right.
To me, we are a help other people as you help yourself, because that's what helps all of us. To me, there's no way that any notion of my allegiance to my country, which is Israel as well, would ever interfere with my desire to help those who need help. The underserved populations, our Black mm-hmm. and Brown brothers and sisters, our LGBT. Right. To me, it's not even an issue. So the fact that it became an issue, essentially in this last 4 years, that the only people who can support Israel are Republicans, it's simply not true. And the fact is, you can be a liberal Zionist. You can be a person who cares deeply and profoundly about the oppression of the Palestinian people, believes in their right to a state, believes in a right to acknowledging the horrendous wrongs that have been done, and also simultaneously, which is something that many I've noticed of the younger generations have trouble holding, simultaneously, you can believe in the right of Israel to exist and not be pushed into the ocean and to have autonomy and safety. And those two things can exist. I believe we can do it. Do we need more help from Arab countries? Yes, we do. Do we possibly need an international force that is more present? Yes, we likely do. But the repeated battering of Israel by the UN to the exclusion of countries with horrendous violations of human rights is disproportionate. And it makes Jewish people feel weird when you keep disproportionately singling Jews out. It makes us feel weird. We are 2% of the US population. Everything's okay. We're happy to live with everybody. We can make this work. Y'all need to turn down the volume on the speaker of the Jews.
No, I think one of the reasons, my dear sister, one often sees this focus on the situation of Israel and occupation and so on, is that the relation to the American empire and this very, very fragile social experiment of a people who've been hated and haunted for 2,000 years. And how do you be fair to the Palestinians themselves? Because in the Jewish tradition itself, we're all made in the image of God. I mean, within the religious discourse of the thing, you see. And so because America is so center stage, you know, in the United Nations, $3 million to the state of Israel, that is hard not to say, well, we need to talk about Tibet. Yes, we do. We got to talk about Western Sahara. Oh, that's occupation. We got to talk about Kashmir. Oh, yes, it is. Those are crucial occupations. And there's, you know, suffering across the board in that regard. When you tie it to the USA, and the USA is such a center staging empire. I mean, everybody's got to go through us. You know,
they have the biggest stick.
Exactly. We're the world power, the money, the military, and so forth. We got some wonderful things about America. We won't even go into Stephen Sondheim right now, but we got some deep oppressions too, and indigenous peoples, Black folk, women, workers, you know, what your parents spent so much of their life with. But I think that's, does that make sense? That's one of the reasons
Israeli. Absolutely. And I didn't mean to sound naive when I was like, what?
But
there also is, there are countries that do not like Israel existing, and they don't like them existing with a Palestinian state, without a Palestinian. Right. I get hate and threats simply for existing as a Jew. So that happened. There are people who just don't like it, and that's also their prerogative within certain parameters.
People don't have a right to hate you now.
No, well, you know,
have a right to hate you in that way. I mean,
not that way. Correct.
Right. Okay. No, we're not gonna have folk hating you.
No. But I'm sure plenty of people hate me. It happens all the time. But what's
what's important is to know that many, many, if not most, of the liberal Jews who are involved in these conversations, we are concerned about the role that the United States is playing.
Oh, right, right.
We are concerned, and I'm not speaking for all Jews. I mean,
no, absolutely.
But really, you're not?
I'm not. It's like asking one black person what black people think about
it. What are all the black folks think? Exactly. Everybody.
But I will say that it is problematic, and these are conversations to have, which in a culture that lacks nuance, it's very difficult to have these conversations.
That's right.
That's
and also, I've been to Israel. I go to Israel every other year since I'm 16 years old. I've been to the territories. I have family who are religious Zionists who live in the territories. They live in armed settlements. And I have family who are secular and live on kibbutz and have a completely different. So I've spent a lot of time there. It's very different when you're there. And I also say that for all the people who think they've figured it out, the people who, you know, my family who immigrated there after the Yom Kippur War, they went there to build that country so that they could have safety and security. I mean, I have many friends who did not feel safe and secure to wear a yarmulke on their head during the Trump administration. And we've already been through this, you know, and that's terrifying. But there needs to be a reassessment of how we frame the United States involvement in that part of the world. And in addition, Netanyahu and Trump were fast friends. There's a lot of things I don't like about the policies of the Israeli government. And I do not believe that a government that has Arabs in Knesset and Arabs holding positions of government, of course we have a way to go. But Arabs serve in the Israeli army. It is a very different situation than what a lot of people understand. There are many places in Israel where there are integrated communities. So there's a lot people don't know. And in addition, I don't love that I can't go to certain countries, but all those countries can come to Israel. I cannot go into countries with Israel stamps on my passport. It's not safe. In many cases, it's not permitted. And Israel does allow people into the country from all those other countries. So we have a disproportionate, you know, set of communication about what these peoples mean to each other. And also Middle Eastern culture is very, very different than Western culture. And when you go there, you see that the discourse is different. Politics is very, very different there. And I'm not forgiving anything, but the notion that like, well, they should get it together. It's very, very complicated. These are thousands of years of battles.
Yeah.
No, but your voice is very important because you're dealing with all of these different complexities on the different levels and registers. But still recognizing that in the end, there's a moral and spiritual standard of excellence that's bigger than each and every one of us. Mm-hmm. You see, I mean, when I enter the discourse, I say to myself, okay, I come as a Christian. We go back to the book of John that begins with some of the most vicious anti-Jewish hatred and prejudice and so forth. There's no Christian civilization that hasn't generated haters of Jews. The Muslims, at their worst, they have the same element. The secular cultures, at their worst. It's in Japan. So, I mean, it's all around the world. So you got these small groups dealing with this kind of hatred in this way, looking for security, looking for safety. And then you jump out of the burning buildings of Europe and you move to Israel and you got Jewish brothers and sisters there. You got Arab brothers and sisters there. How are you going to deal with it? Boober and Hami says it's got to be binational. We got to make sure it's coexisting. Well, Jabotinsky comes along. He said, no, we can't trust anybody. This is going to be zero-sum game. It's either them or us. And so you have this unbelievable struggle within the Jewish soul, within the Jewish country, but it's in the context of unbelievable hatred, unbelievable haunting. So this is one of the ways at least laying out the context, you see. And you say, well, good God Almighty, you know, these Palestinian brothers and sisters, they have to be able to find their place in the sun in such a way that they can flower and flourish like Jews, Black folk, indigenous peoples. Is a two-state possible now? It looked as if we were holding on to that, you know, with the settlements increasing. How do you talk about a two-state? It's hard to find a way out. It's hard to find a way out.
I mean, I can't tell you how many times over the many, many years that I've been going to Israel, and my family, you know, they were living in a tiny apartment in Jerusalem, and they were offered these beautiful homes in the West Bank. And it looks like what you think of when you think of biblical Israel. It's just like rolling dunes. There's nothing out there. So of course they took the opportunity. I mean, Bibi was giving it away, right? But the notion that, you know, the notion that you could, and I don't mean to make it so much about what happened in this country, the notion that you could look at everything that was happening with that administration and say, all right, I'm okay with that because hashtag Israel, it to me as a Jew, it's unconscionable. It is unconscionable. And it's astounding to me because we have to be able to hold that tension and be able to say we're working towards something and we're not there yet. And here are all of the reasons and here's what needs to happen. It is a tragic situation. It is tragic, but this journey is also not over. You know, when I was a kid, Jews were brought over in secret from Russia. Jews were brought over in secret from Africa so that they could live freely. And now they experience racism in Israel by other Jews. Like,
right. Human beings, we're human, all of us human in that way.
Yeah, the whole thing is unbelievable, though.
But when black folk went to Liberia and didn't treat the indigenous Africans, all of them beautifully black. I mean, it's a human thing in that regard. But I just love, we don't want to, you know, go on, but I just love the way you're wrestling with this by keeping the spiritual and the moral there.
Thank you.
And it's not a question of you having to have a full agreement on X or Y or whatever. But if we give up on the moral and spiritual standards, so we say, oh, that precious Jewish baby in Tel Aviv has the same value as that precious Palestinian baby in Gaza, and we're going to hold on to that, and let's see then how we can deal with these complexities. I mean, that's why I think what you're doing is so very important. Do not get discouraged by having to cut against the grain, because there's a lot of censorship out there, there's a lot of repression out there, and you say, now I come from a people who lift every voice. Now, you know, that's the black national anthem, but that applies to everybody, including Jewish brothers and sisters.
Yeah Let me switch gears because I want to make sure we get a couple of other topics in, and this is a perfect segue, which is about the sort of the question of one's, you know, moral and ethical standards and how we apply it. You know, Hollywood is a complicated place for a whole different set of reasons. I'm not sure it's as complex as, you know, conflicts in the Middle East, but it is its own battleground. And you've been able to sort of take on what I would say are decidedly interesting and unusual female lead roles, roles that, you know, no, really, that are much richer than your typical sort of sitcom, you know, wifey girly roles, right? And you have a new show coming out that seems to be continuing in that. Do you write all these things yourself? Do you, you know, hold people until they give you these roles? Do you go on hunger strikes? How is it that you are able to sort of take those kinds of roles and bring them to the fore in an industry where, you know, we still have amazing actresses who have to sit and cut vegetables in the kitchen during a sitcom, you know?
I mean, this is a great question. And, you know, I feel like I'm among friends here. It's also an intellectual kind of, you know, challenge. There's a way that in particular women are supposed to look in Hollywood. And, you know, by nature of my genetics and being an Eastern European mutt, I don't look like those women. And so I don't get cast in a lot of the parts that give you sort of traditional Hollywood success. I'm what they call a character actress. Back in the day, they used to say, I used to get called in for parts where the breakdown, you know, of like what parts they're looking for would say, submit all ethnicities. And I would go, I would go, that should be the title of my memoir.
Yeah.
Submit all ethnicities. And what that meant was that was the non, you know, they used to call it all American. They wanted all American people as the main characters. That was white, small featured, WASPs. I mean, that's just what, you know, in the 80s, that's what was popular. Right. So I would go under submit all ethnicities. And I started getting cast in kind of character roles. And I was in Beaches when I was 12. I played the young Bette Midler character in that movie.
Right.
And it was after that I did Blossom. And Don Rio, Who started as the straight man for Slappy White. He was a comedian. He wrote Blossom kind of as, we wanted to do kind of a sitcom version of Catcher in the Rye based around a girl. And at the time, there were no shows about girls on network television. They thought we were crazy. They said, no one's going to watch this. We premiered after the Cosby Show. That's how old I am. And, you know, we had this 5-year run with this character, exactly what you're talking about, who was a real person. She wasn't the bimbo and she wasn't the nerd. She was what many women are and many men as well. We're a combination. We're a combination of goofy and serious and loving and cold. We're all those things. We tried to create a rich character. And, you know, I left the industry after that. I was happily, you know, I had long hippie chick hair. I didn't even know what size clothes I was. I just like pulled on whatever was around. I got back into acting because I was running out of health insurance. This is a true story. I had an infant and a toddler. I didn't know I was going to be on The Big Bang Theory. I just went to audition for it. And I figured if I can just get some my SAG insurance back, I'll at least have insurance. I was cast in this show. I'm not a TV watcher. I think you can tell by talking to me. I'm not a pop culture person at all.
You're so reading your text.
I'm literally studying Jewish law. Like that's what I do in my, and I do puzzles. So I was cast in this show. And honestly, it was like 9 years later, I woke up and my life again, you know, had changed. I was teaching neuroscience. I was tutoring Hebrew and piano. I was doing whatever I could to make ends meet. I was not planning on returning to this world, but it keeps wanting me. So, you know, where I ended up was working with Chuck Lorre and Bill Prady on The Big Bang Theory, which, love it or hate it, was the most popular comedy in America. And I got to inhabit this scientist character who was a lot like me, and she was socially awkward and she was weird. And we purposely made her kind of androgynous. Like she wasn't trying to win Sheldon over with her curves. She was just a woman like a lot of us are. She was a scientist. She didn't really care much. And like, they still fell in love because people like that can still meet and fall in love. And then here I am, Jim Parsons, who played Sheldon after Big Bang, said to me, we want to make a show based on this British show, Miranda, about a really quirky, kind of annoying woman. And if anyone can pull that off and be lovable, it's you. And so now I'm like in this show, it's called Call Me Cat. It's on Thursday nights. And like, it's a sitcom about a very, very quirky woman. She's kind of klutzy. She's vulgar. She really is good with other people's feelings. Hers are hard. She's socially anxious. She owns a cat cafe. And we just want to make America laugh. That's really all we're trying to do, you know?
Right.
So that's my life as as an unusual looking woman. You know, I'm an unadorned feminist. People generally let us be, you know?
Yeah. That's one way to put it. Yeah, they let you be. So basically, they discriminated against you into success is what happened. They discriminated against you into stardom.
I use the word discrimination, I'm sure you can imagine, for much more specific and politically charged conversations. But, I think my story is the story of a lot of people. I just was me, you know, and I didn't fit the boxes.
But it is discrimination, though. I'm going to push a little bit on that because it is to say, look, if there's an all ethnicities category, which is basically to say these are the non-important, unwashed masses of non-blonde white women, right? That's how hierarchies of race are established. That's how value is reconfirmed. That's how stories get told and how other people's stories don't get told, right? Correct. I actually like The Big Bang Theory. My mild critique is it'd be nice to have a couple of black people in there. I'd probably like a black.
It's as if Pasadena has no black people. We know. It's very strange.
I mean, you know, it's like they're a handful of black scientists. I know a few. I'm related to a few. You know, they exist. And, you know, just would have been nice. But beyond that, I mean, I think it's important to say that that's how these narratives of who's at the center. I mean, I think about Friends and its longstanding state, you know, I'm like, really, what city are you in again?
Exactly? Yeah, no, that's, you know, even Seinfeld, but I think that is a good point. And also it is a strong element of the patriarchy and systemic
racism.
Structures of racism. Yeah, correct. Yeah. You know, the fact that at a size 6'8", I'm 3 sizes bigger than your average female that I interact with, that I'm considered hard to fit. I'm considered big. She's, you know, like I got curves, and it's like, you know, I'm a Jewish lady. This is how, like, we're zoftig. Like, this is how our bodies are.
I don't think a six is zoftig, but we'll
that's it. Alone. You just no, but I think that that's one of the things about the show Call Me Cat is, like, I don't wear Spanx in real life. I don't really believe in it. And so I get to be a normal size woman, you know, I'm an eight, right. I'm a comfy eight after COVID, I'm a comfy eight, you know, yeah. I even feel good in a 10, so I don't have to suck it in too much, you know. But that's another thing about this show, Call Me Cat, is that we're set in Louisville, and we have chosen to have a diverse cast. And it means a lot to us that when we cast guest spots, that we are looking to have our show be a reflection of what many cities in America look like, and in particular, Louisville.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Fantastic. That's really good to know.
This is just so rich and so much fun, I must say.
we've spanned the whole territory.
You've got such a wonderful spirit about you, as well intellectual subtlety. But now, is it true that you're working on a project with Dustin Hoffman?
It is true.
Tell us a little bit about that.
So this is a very, you know, I had never written a screenplay. And after my father died, as a process of grief, the Jewish grieving process is very specific. I don't know if you know much about traditional Judaism and how we grieve. We don't wear bright colors for a year. We don't go to parties. We don't hear live music. We say Kaddish, which is a prayer that you have to say in the presence of 10 people. So you have to be with 10 people 3 times a day is what you aim for as a man. And I chose to do this as a woman, which I, in many communities where I would recite this prayer, I was the only woman who had ever said it in this synagogue.
Really?
And I traveled for a year. I recited Kaddish every day for my father. And I said it in Savannah. I said it in Israel, all over New York and New Jersey. Wherever I was, I found a synagogue.
That's powerful. That's powerful.
It was a very intense year. And one of the things that I noticed is that I started having, not flashbacks, but visual memories of my childhood with my dad. And I thought, you know, I think these need to go on paper. And it was a psychological, I mean, I've been in therapy literally since before I was born. So, you know, I spoke to my therapist about it. And what evolved was not a memoir, not an autobiography, but a portrait of a family a lot like mine that had a tremendous amount of love and passion and creativity, and also had mental illness, because I grew up in a home with mental illness. And I wrote about what happens when a family is divided, and in particular, when siblings deal with parents like this differently. So I literally didn't show it to anybody for a year. I've never written a screenplay. I wrote what I knew. And a very long story short, Dustin Hoffman and Candace Bergen are set to play the parents in this screenplay that I will be directing. We're just waiting on vaccines and COVID scheduling. It's called As Sick As They Made Us, which is a play on words, because we are as sick as our parents made us, and we're also as sick as they make us just by interacting with us. And Dustin Hoffman was really touched by my writing, and almost every family that I know has got a story of someone who doesn't speak to this one, or this one we never hear from, or this one does drugs, but we don't talk about it, or this one is an alcoholic, but let's not talk about it. Every family's got something. You can be rich, you can be poor, black, white, it doesn't matter. Mental illness touches every single part of this globe. You are not immune from it. And I wanted to write this story as really a cathartic process. I never thought Dustin Hoffman would be like eyes watering, telling me how much this script meant to him. And Candace Bergen, like, I mean, it's unbelievable. Simon Helberg from Big Bang Theory is playing the son, and Olivia Thirlby's cast to play the daughter. And, you know, I'm not looking to reinvent the wheel as a director. You know, I'm very specific about my plans to make a film. I don't need to reinvent the wheel. This is a story about people interacting. So I have a great director of photography lined up, and we just need COVID scheduling to be on our side.
Congratulations.
Yeah, congrats on that. That's going to be amazing.
Your towering talent, though.
As sick as they make us.
Yep.
This is something. You got to come back when that comes out.
I think I'm moving in with both of you. You're my aunt. That's it. I'll start walking.
We're all set. I already got your toothbrush ready. Well, it's been so fantastic. This has been just a real joy talking with you. Just very nourishing, really grounded, and really inspiring.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Intellectual delight, spiritual delight,
really moral wrestling,
political wrestling, but just we just hope that your loved ones are safe and stay steadfast.
Thank you.
You just keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you. Well, mostly I'm making my children watch documentaries about Black people. We watched the 13th. We're going to watch Crack next. We've taken this year as an opportunity to get educated because
the
country's on fire. The country is on fire. And like literally my kids, they said, if we have to hear one more time how privileged we are, I said, you're going to keep hearing it. Because I'm sorry if you're bored. Some people don't even have the space to socially distance. So buck up, children.
They've got that's true.
Thoughts on them. I don't know if you've seen Chasing Train yet with Brother John. Yeah, Brother John, definitely. It's one of the best movies made on John Coltrane's Love Supreme.
Oh, wow. Okay,
that's very good.
Oh, so you get the young folk in on that. He said, oh, yeah.
They like anything that's not a crime documentary about horrible police systems. So I'll add to the list.
Well, because, you know, it's important to know both what people are facing in terms of racism and structural oppression, but it's also really important to them to get a deep appreciation for what African-American culture has created, done, and given, because
absolutely
it's seeing that tension that is actually allows you to appreciate the suffering it more complexly than just top down. Right.
That's, I mean, I named him Miles for Miles Davis, so he had a head start.
Well, then you'll have to definitely show him that film. That's a good one.
He got a jump start from the very beginning.
Yes.
You and his blessed father as well.
Thank you.
But thank you so much.
Yes, indeed.
Thank you so much.
This was a tremendous highlight of my life. Thank you so much, both of you.
Wow, Cornell, that was a great dialogue, huh?
I'm telling you, our dear sister, Miami, she's got a beautiful spirit about her. She's got a subtlety in her mind, openness and dialogue. You know, a lot of times people put stereotypes on other people. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Dogmatic about this and that. No, she was very flexible. She was engaged in Socratic dialogue in a very rich and honest manner.
Very, very down to earth, you know, and it was a really good conversation. Enjoyed, especially listening to you all, you know, talk about religion and politics and in very nuanced ways. That was really great. Well, we get this another amazing tightrope moment. We're just racking them up in 2021. It's been great to be here with you, Cornell, as always. And I want to thank all the tightrope people out there who are watching, listening, hanging out, writing to us, and coming to join us on YouTube and Patreon and, you know, Apple, Spotify, and all those various venues. So join us, subscribe, let us know what you think, and send us your suggestions. And we really hope to see you next time on the tightrope with me and Dr. Cornell West. Cornell, I can't wait to see you again next time.
And my dear sister Tricia, take good care now.
I'll do my best. All right, take care, everybody.